I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Professor Steven Spiegel, director of the Center for Middle East Development at UCLA, and an expert on American foreign policy in the Middle East, Israel, and peace issues. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom throughout the august and illustrious history of the Two Jewish Radio Show, and we are now just 17 shows shy of having recorded 500 fabulous editions of the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends. We have always focused on the big question of Jewish identity in America and elsewhere in the diaspora. What shapes it, what changes it, and what direction is it going? And one of the key issues for Jewish identity in America in 2011, as it has been for some time, is our connection to Israel. In fact, you could make a case that for many years, we American Jews have raised our children on a mix of Holocaust education, connection to Israel, and Jewish holidays. And that's about it. Except in the Reform Movement, where we do a lot of social action, food drives, blood drives, social justice issues, immigration, and good causes of all kinds, with just a tiny little bit of Jewish cuisine thrown in, mostly bagels and lox. Unfortunately, we have reduced Judaism to a very few elements, and not always the most important ones, to be honest. Like, you know, God, ethics, belief, practice, you know, those sorts of things. Anyway, having said that, I think it's nearly impossible to explore Jewish identity today without reflecting on Israel and its place in our lives. More Jews now live in Israel than anywhere else in the world. More Jewish scholarship and creativity comes from Israel than anywhere else in the world. And more Jewish controversy emanates from Israel than anywhere else in the world. And while most diaspora Jews don't actually spend that much time in Israel, even I, who have been there 13 times, have lived there for about a year and a half all told and planning to lead another trip to Israel in June, I have only spent about 3% of my life actually in Israel. Nonetheless, we certainly care about issues involving Israel, dedicate a fair amount of our charity dollars to Israel and Israel-related causes, and talk about Israel a lot. And the American relationship with Israel is a big part of that. I know a number of important American Jewish leaders for whom the American government's relationship with Israel is actually the centerpiece of their entire Jewish involvement, indeed, of their entire Jewish identity. They spend time, money, and effort to work to influence important American politicians to vote for pro-Israel measures, to limit anti-Israel measures. Well, while working for Israel's success and international stability is laudable and very important, all that seems to be changing. After all, the current state of Israeli-American government relations is in many ways remarkably robust, and it almost seems not to matter anymore who is in the White House or what they really feel about Israeli leaders. Or does it matter? Over the next few weeks, with a couple of exceptions, our guests will be folks who have thought and taught long and hard on the current relationship between Israel and America, how it might be changing, and what direction it's likely to take in the future. Many polls, while continuing to show that the American public has an extremely high opinion of Israel and our support for Israel, have also shown that younger Americans don't necessarily share those views. And, of course, in other parts of the world, including many parts of Europe, Israel is not well thought of at all. What to make of all this? Well, we'll explore this starting this morning with our guest today, Steven Spiegel, about whom you'll hear more in just a moment. But to play us in on this topic, here's a rare novelty. American jazz singer Al Jolson singing HaTikva, the national anthem of Israel, in his own often imitated style. Note the Ashkenazic pronunciation of the Hebrew of HaTikva, long archaic now, but not in Al Jolson's time.
O Lord, Balev of Pnimah, Nefesh
That was Al Jolson singing HaTikvah as it was sung in the United States back in the day. Professor Steven Spiegel is director of the Center for Middle East Development at UCLA and literally an author of the textbook on world politics. He's written widely on the U.S.'s approach to the Middle East and its relationship with Israel and developed cutting-edge negotiating strategies that have helped to shape the approach to peace all through the region. Find out if peace work is even possible in the Middle East today when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. The other day when I was struggling to come up with an idea for a new Mama's commercial, I overheard a family talking about their son's high school football team. My mind raced back to 1964 in Long Island, New York, when my brother Vinny played football for the West Hempstead High School Rams. Vinny was a great player, and of course the whole Spina family went to each and every game. After the games, we'd often come home and Mom would make one of her delicious Sicilian-style pizzas. My mouth still waters when I think of the great rich-tasting tomato sauce and creamy fresh mozzarella cheese sitting on top of her warm, homemade semolina dough. It's the exact great taste we put into the pizzas we make every day at our mama's restaurants in Tucson. You know, I love thinking about football and the good old days in New York. I just wish all this reminiscing would help me come up with a good idea for a new radio commercial. Repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Tucson Hebrew Academy is now enrolling students for the fall. THA always knew they had the best kindergarten in town, and now it's official. Following the Outstanding Teacher Award presented by the Jewish Federation of Southern Arizona to THA's kindergarten teacher, Jackie Miller. Kindergarten through 8th grade curriculum centers on rigorous academics infused with Jewish values and ethics, providing a well-rounded educational experience. While many schools have cut the all-important arts, physical education, and health classes, THA is integrating them into the curriculum in a safe, nurturing environment. We graduate capable, confident students poised for the next chapter in their lives, prepared to enter higher levels of school, and ready to contribute to the larger community. Tucson Hebrew Academy is an award-winning Blue Ribbon school. Last year, THA awarded over $700,000 in financial assistance to students and their families. Great education is more affordable than you think. The best education comes from THA. Space is limited, including in their kindergarten. Call 529-3888 today to register or arrange a private tour. That's 529-3888 or visit THAAZ.org. We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning, Professor Steven Spiegel. He's professor of political science at UCLA, studies American foreign policy in the Middle East, the American relationship to, well, the entire Middle East. His PhD is from a small college called Harvard University, joined the UCLA faculty in 1966. He has authored and co-authored over 100 books, articles, and papers. He has literally written the textbook on international relations, World Politics in a New Era. Its fourth edition, most recently, was published by Oxford University Press. He's working on a book on the American approach to the Middle East. He's also the director of the Center for Middle East Development at UCLA. And in 1995, he received the Carp Peace Prize, awarded to the UCLA professor, considered to have done the most of any faculty member, and it's a large faculty for the cause of world peace. Good morning. Welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you.
Well, it's been quite a year in the Middle East, with first an Arab winter and then an Arab spring and maybe an Arab summer. And what does all this mean for Israel and for the American relationship with Israel? Nice, small, concise question to start.
Well, I think that, first of all, the situation in the Middle East is more complex. It has the potential to get much better, but it could get worse. The dictatorships and autocracies of the past, and of course there are so many of them still in this region, provided a certain degree of stability. And people were accustomed to dealing with particular leaders who lasted for decades, and Israeli leaders got used to dealing with the Mubaraks, for example. Now, it's much more complicated because you don't know what's going to happen. The Islamists are likely to gain, although they're likely to be moderate Islamists. But we don't quite know yet what that means. And they may be moderate in terms of violence. They may be moderate in terms of some of the internal attitudes towards social matters, but they're not particularly moderate towards Israel. Not that they want to go to war with Israel, but they don't want to fraternize with Israelis either. So it's a much more complicated situation and much more unpredictable than has been the case in the past.
You know, it doesn't sound good to Americans to hear that Israelis would have preferred to deal with Mubarak or, you know, even to a degree in its back-channel way with people like Assad than with a democratically created government. Can you explain that it isn't exactly like that always in the Middle East?
Well, first of all, I didn't say that the Israelis would prefer the others. I just said that the situation is more complicated, and I think that there is an important differentiation. Secondly, it's critical to remember that several Israelis have said that they feel that this situation holds prospects for considerable improvement for Israel, particularly, for example, if Assad were to go, then the Iranian position would be weakened in the region quite measurably. There would be a situation wherein you would have a presumably less Syrian influence over Hezbollah, and Hezbollah would be weaker. So there are a lot of benefits to these changes. For example, in Egypt, the Israeli government, for all the popular animosity that has been expressed toward Israel, the Egyptian government is working quite well at the moment with the Israelis, and that's partially behind the Gilad Shalit deal and the exchange of prisoners that you've now had between that you're now in the process of having between Egypt and Israel. So while it's more complicated, I didn't mean to suggest that there aren't more opportunities, and that's what we're going to have to face, because if Israel can weather the storm, so to speak, and enhance over time its relationship with the Egyptian government, it's much better to deal with a government that is more popular. Now, part of the complexity is the current Egyptian government is losing popularity because it's an interim government and it's still the military. We don't know what an elected government might be like, but my main point is there are enhanced opportunities, but also enhanced challenges.
We will talk much more with Professor Steve Spiegel when we come back on Too Jewish.
At Handmaker's Senior Day programs, variety and interesting activities help Barbara Sanders really enjoy her time there.
They have a lot of activities that I like to do. They have ceramics, they have painting, they have sewing. We go out to the museums and to the parks, and we also go to the casino.
Handmaker helps seniors and disabled individuals maintain their independence longer than they might otherwise. Handmaker's flexible scheduling makes the Senior Day program very convenient, and Barbara feels right at home.
The staff is very nice. They take good care of you. They'll make sure that you have everything you need.
And there are other benefits, too.
All of my grandchildren have piggy banks that I've made from here, and I have a lot of ceramics in my house now because of here.
Call Handmaker at 322-7035 for more information and a complimentary one-day pass. There are new people and new friends to meet.
They're not just friendships. You know, you actually are a part of a family.
Handmaker Senior Day Program serves all faiths, centrally located on Rosemont, just south of TMC. Call 322-7035.
Please plan to join me on Sunday, November 6th, for a fantastic evening honoring Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, starting at 5:30 p.m. It will be a memorable night indeed. The Tucson Hebrew Academy is holding its 7th annual Tikkun Olam event. That's Sunday, November 6th at 5:30 p.m. at the Jewish Community Center. Tikkun Olam means repair the world, and it's an important call to action for Jews everywhere in the world. Who better personifies this than Gabby Giffords? This wonderful evening will bring the entire community together to honor Congresswoman Giffords. She'll be joined by her friend and colleague, Congresswoman Shelley Berkeley from Nevada, with a very special MC, Dr. Richard Carmona, the 17th Surgeon General of the United States. Proceeds from the event go to benefit the Tucson Hebrew Academy's scholarship and affordability programs. It'll feature music, a silent and live auction, and great food. Tickets are on sale, and some sponsorship opportunities still remain. Call 520-529-3888 today for more information, or visit the website at thaaz.org. Let's join together in the spirit of Tikkun Olam, honoring Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords on Sunday, November 6th, and supporting Jewish education and scholarship. Call THA at 529-3888 or go to the website thaaz.org. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio@Yahoo.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio at Yahoo. Or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear past and present shows through the website or downloading us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Our pilgrimage trip to Israel is now set for June of 2012. By the way, if you want to go with me, email us at TooJewishRadio@Yahoo or call 520-327-4501. There was some important news on the baseball front last week. In addition to two Jewish guys playing in the World Series, Ian Kinsler and Scott Feldman of the Texas Rangers, rock star general manager Theo Epstein, formerly of the Boston Red Sox, officially changed jobs, becoming the Chicago Cubs president of baseball operations. Epstein, who is Jewish and from Brookline, Massachusetts, took over the Red Sox in 2002 at age 28. He was then the youngest GM in baseball history. At that time, the Red Sox had not won a World Series since 1918. They were widely considered to be under the curse of the Bambino due to their trade of Babe Ruth to the Yankees. By 2004, the Red Sox had won their first World Championship under Theo Epstein, in large part due to his acquisitions of David Ortiz, Curt Schilling, and Kevin Millar, among others. The Red Sox won another World Series during Epstein's tenure in 2007. But after the Sox meltdown this September, Theo Epstein resigned. He now has an even more difficult task on his hands, if possible, taking the Chicago Cubs to the World Series. The Cubs have not appeared in one since 1945. They have not won a World Series in over a century. As my friend Norm Golden, a Cubs fan, says, "Oh, any team can have a bad century." Epstein, who greeted his first press conference as GM in Boston by saying, "I haven't seen this many people in a room since my bar mitzvah," has quite a task on his hands. But you know, it really is logical that Chicago finally hires a Jewish baseball head like Theo Epstein. I mean, if we could reestablish our country, Israel, after a nearly 1,900-year hiatus, how hard can it be to get the Cubs to a world title when it's only been 103 years? Mazel tov to Theo Epstein on his new job, and of course, good luck. He'll need it with the Cubs. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart. Boker tov, Guy, good morning.
Boker tov.
So this is a weird question. It's October 30th. American kids are all preparing for Halloween, October 31st, tomorrow night. Halloween doesn't mean anything in Israel, does it?
Well, honestly, it doesn't. I never heard of it before coming to the States. For me, it's kind of an American version for Purim. You know, in Israel, Purim is the big festival of costumes. People dress up, wear the costumes. Adults get drunk and stuff.
It's a crazy night, isn't it?
Yeah, Purim is really crazy in Israel. People have parties all night.
People on the streets all till all hours, dressed in costumes, walking around. It's really fantastic.
People come to the office dressed in costumes. Sometimes you can't recognize your boss because he's dressed like, you know, like a monster or something. Well, if he's a monster, you probably recognize him.
I know they used to dress up like Saddam Hussein. I don't know, Ahmadinejad, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff.
Yeah, there were times where some kids used to dress up as terrorists and stuff, but today people avoid from doing that.
Yeah, that's probably not a good idea in Israel, I'm sorry.
Because people don't see it as a joke anymore.
So, as sort of an odd question. Now, you know, obviously they don't have the dress-up custom that we have for Halloween. We do have it on Purim, which is a much older festival probably than Halloween. But a different question. There is a lot of kind of mystical qualities to Israeli society. And Halloween is about witches and all this stuff. But there's a certain, I don't know how to say it, superstitious quality to some aspects of Israeli society where people look for amulets and... But there's a certain level of superstition, even for a modern country like Israel. Can you talk about that just a little bit?
Well, you know, in some traditions, some of them Jewish communities that came over from Africa, from Asia, but also Jewish communities that came from Ashkenaz have some old superstitions. It's usually more with the grandmothers. You know, when the grandmothers, they come to you, and it can start with blessings, with you know, with a tzedakah, with 100 shekels waving around your head like a kaparot in Yom Kippur,
right?
Which is, by the way, interesting, the connection between the names Yom Kippur and Purim. You know, it's an interesting connection. And of course, there are a lot of people know the chamsa, the hand side with the five fingers.
Right, you see that a lot, and people buy those necklaces because they're so attractive, the chamsa. But that's really a superstitious symbol.
Yeah, it's kind of a symbol that is supposed to block evil spirits or something of that sort and bring you good luck. And the number five is considered to bring good luck. And also, if you see those chamsas that in the middle, they have this... more of the old people kind of believe in what's called Ayin Hara.
Right, the evil eye.
The evil eye, when somebody's looking at something and feels envy, and thus he creates some bad luck to that person. You see it a lot when new babies are born. And for instance, if someone comes and say on the baby that the baby is so beautiful, the grandpa will jump on and say, no, it is an ugly baby. It's not beautiful. It's not. Yeah, so you see that.
Lest the evil eye see it and take it or damage the child in some way, right?
Exactly.
So even in a modern country like Israel, they have some of the same superstition, even without Halloween.
And, you know, nobody argues with grandma when she comes and say, yeah, that's a good blessing. You say, okay, doesn't hurt, let her bless. And let's see if it works.
God willing. Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the outstanding restaurateur, Janos Wilder, of Janos Restaurant, the J Bar in Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Janos Restaurant's finest restaurant around. What's cooking there for the holidays?
I'm so excited about the holidays. Fantastic food. Place looks beautiful. All the private dining rooms. Rabbi, I'll even come and cater at your house.
Sounds fantastic. How about Saturday night?
Perfect.
You can do Hanukkah for us soon. New Year's. I've got Christian friends. You can do Christmas. You've got wonderful private rooms at Janos.
We want to make the holidays easy for you. We have the private rooms. We'll cook at your house. You can buy gift certificates as gifts for your friends. We want you to have a wonderful holiday season. We want it to be delicious. And we want to take the worry out of it for you.
As only Janos can. That's JANOS.com. What's the phone number to call?
615-6100.
See you for the holidays at Janos.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Want to know what's really going on in the relationship between Israel and America? Find out Wednesday, November 9th from 1 to 9 p.m. at the University of Arizona's Student Union Memorial Center, the South Ballroom, as the Arizona Center for Judaic Studies invites the community to its symposium on the U.S.-Israel relationship on the verge of a paradigmatic shift. Internationally renowned scholars and diplomats will discuss these critically important issues. The symposium speakers include Peter Beinart, Itamar Rabinovich, Steve Spiegel, Alon Pincus, David Makovsky, and Gil Ryback. They'll all discuss the key question of whether the U.S. is on the verge of a dramatic change in its relationship with Israel, or whether it's simply going through a phase like it has gone through before. The symposium is for everyone, students and scholars, policymakers, and the general public. It's open to all. To register, contact the Arizona Center for Judaic Studies. Call 520-626-5758. That's 626-5758. Or contact Judaic Studies on the web through their website, Judaic, J-U-D-A-I-C dot Arizona dot E-D-U. Call 626-5758 for tickets. General admission is $18 a person. Sponsorships are available. Admission is free with a valid U of A CAT card or $18 without. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about the really fascinating and huge topic of the Cairo Geniza, the storehouse or repository for old Jewish books, texts that dated from the 8th, 9th, 10th century and so on, was walled up and then, you said, at one point moved. And when it was finally kind of rediscovered in the 19th century, some of the text drifted out. The story I heard is they were doing a remodel. They broke through the wall and look, lo and behold, here's a, you know, Dunash bin Labrat poem from the 10th century nobody ever seen. But it's a little more complicated than that. Some of these began, you said, to drift into the antiquities market. And then what happened?
Well, you may actually be right, and I love being corrected on the air. It's perfectly fine. At one point, the synagogue was moved from a quarter of Cairo that had become very poor and what the French call quartier populaire, you know, very slummy. And Jews didn't want to go there anymore. They thought it was dangerous and dirty and insalubrious and whatever. So they moved the synagogue. And actually, the 19th century discovery of the Geniza may have been, in fact, from a remodeling. But the point is that probably many synagogues in Cairo had their genizot, but the one that started leaking out late in the 19th century was this one from the synagogue you visited. And eventually, certain scholars, particularly in England, got their hands on some of these fragments, and they were tantalized by, where'd you get this? What's the source? And one of these scholars was Solomon Schechter, who became, not too much later in his life, the chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York, and after whom many conservative Jewish day schools are named. And he, it turns out, was quite a fiery, almost piratical character. He really comes to life in this book, along with many other Geniza scholars. In any case, long story short, he gets permission from the British government and from either Oxford or Cambridge, whichever, which were also in competition, to see who could get a bigger chunk of the Cairo Geniza, to ship as much of it as he could get in a special container, sealed, so that it wouldn't have to go through customs, directly to England, where he starts looking at this and says, this is going to take me the rest of my life. And he was wrong, because actually scholars are still working on this. Even with the aid of computers and everything else, yeah, a lot of these fragments were torn. They were scattered. They came up, a bit of a document came up in Moscow, and another bit came up in Rome, and another bit came up in England. And you have to put these together like a gigantic jigsaw puzzle. But on top of that, pages of paper were so rare in the early Middle Ages that in many cases, the script was erased and written over. So the task of the Geniza scholars is to find out what was underneath it. And what was underneath it was very often from late antiquity, like 4th, 5th, 6th century. Mm. And then it was written over 500 years later.
Wow.
So you have not one super old document, but two incredibly old documents on the same piece of paper. And deciphering that, putting it in context, making sense of it, has often caused revolutions in the study of Jewish history, Jewish theology, Jewish sociology, and Jewish lifestyles throughout this medieval period. And not only on the Jewish community in Cairo, but because one woman's son is living in Prague and another woman's daughter is living in Vienna, and they're writing back and forth, you learn stuff about the Jewish communities in Vienna and Prague and the Jewish trade routes with ties to India, etc., etc., all through the Middle Ages.
Absolutely. And, you know, I actually want to continue on that next week because I even know a tiny bit about that.
Great.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Rachel meets Rabbi Landau while out shopping. "Hello, Rabbi," she says. "Oh, it's Mrs. Cohen, isn't it?" he asks. "Yes, Rabbi," says Rachel. "I haven't seen you in shul for some time," says Rabbi Landau. "Yeah, you're right, Rabbi," says Rachel. "I stopped going because every time I go, it's always the same thing." "The same thing, Mrs. Cohen," says Rabbi Landau. "What do you mean?" "Oh, you know, Rabbi, they're always singing the same song," says Rachel. "Kol Nidre." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. You see, you only sing Kol Nidre on Yom Kippur, the evening of the Day of Atonement, once a year. And if you only go to shul one day, that's all you would hear and... forget it. This week, we read the Torah portion of Lech Lecha, which includes God's great command to Abram. Lech Lecha me'artzacha me'mladatcha me'beit avicha, leave. Go from your country and your homeland and the house of your father to a land I will show you. This is the beginning of monotheism, the belief in one God. It's the beginning of Judaism, and it will prove to be the beginning of our connection to the land of Israel as well. A dramatic and powerful moment. You know, the fascinating thing about Lech Lecha is not that God commands Abram, later to be renamed Abraham, to leave everything he's known. After all, if he is to create a new religion and remake belief in our world, he will need to leave polytheism, multiple gods, and a pagan society that doesn't recognize the concept of justice and supreme divine power. If you want to live a life of goodness and blessing, you need to leave home sometimes just to do it. Anyway, Abraham picked up and left the sophisticated, morally challenged city-states of Babylon. He journeyed outward to find God and to found a new religion. That journey of differentiation was pivotal to all human history. If Abraham doesn't just do what God commands him, there is no Judaism, which means no Christianity and no Islam, no monotheism, no Western civilization at all. What's most fascinating about Abraham's actions in this week's Torah portion of Lech Lecha is that after God commanded him to go, he just went without argument or controversy. That strikes me as a very un-Jewish approach. After all, the essence of Jewish culture often seems to be argument and discussion. If you were directed to leave everything you had ever known and told to move somewhere unspecified, wouldn't you complain at least a little? And please don't think that Abraham is incapable of arguing with God. In fact, he proves in next week's Torah portion that he will argue and bargain with God to the last degree. And he does just that, trying to defend the few righteous men of Sodom and Gomorrah. No, something else is at work here. The essential understanding that we all have that sometimes you just have to move on. Leave what you know and embrace the journey. In order to fully realize who we can become, we must first leave who we have been. It's an exciting, exhilarating, daunting prospect, dangerous, yet essential. And if we can choose to take the first steps, we may, like Abraham, reap rich rewards. Our Jewish poetry slam this morning comes from the great Yiddish poet Jacob Glatstein, Yaakov Glatstein. It's based on this week's portion of Lech Lecha, God's call to Abraham. The poem is called Genesis. Why don't we just start all over again with a small people, out of the cradle and little? The two of us, wanderers over the nations, tillers of the soil, will bow before you. You'll live on burnt offerings of grain. I'll go around preaching folk wisdom. It won't reach past our borders, but the least little child will greet me good morning. Why don't we both go home and start over from the very beginning, out of our littleness? Almighty God, who has waxed great over the seven firmaments and continents, swollen steel strong in vast churches and synagogues, Lord of the universe, you've deserted field and barn. I, the close love of my people, we've both turned universal. Come back, dear God, to a land no bigger than a speck. Dwindle down to only ours. I'll go around with homie's sayings suitable for chewing over in small places. We'll both be provincial, God and his poet. Maybe it will go sweeter for us. Our Jewish poetry slam from poet Jacob Glatstein, translated by author Cynthia Ozick. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, Professor Steven Spiegel of UCLA, will explain the future of the American relationship to Israel. When we return on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Responding to an international appeal by Ankara following last Sunday's 7.2 magnitude earthquake that killed more than 400 people and forced thousands to flee their homes in the eastern Van province of Turkey, Israel flew out some prefabricated homes and is preparing to ship hundreds more by sea. We said that we would prepare to provide Turkey all possible aid as they desire and request, and there's no mixing political diplomatic relations and natural disasters, said Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman of Israel. We are separating the two things absolutely. Israeli relief after a 1999 Turkish earthquake then helped seal a strategic partnership that has since collapsed in the wake of the Mavi Marmara incident in 2010 and Turkey's move to increase its influence in the Arab world in the wake of the Arab Spring. Despite the crisis, Turkey's Islamist-rooted government was the very first country to dispatch firefighters to help Israel contain the deadly blaze in the Carmel forests in December. When a country is in distress and has humanitarian problems, it is right to help and put things aside, said Ehud Shani, Director General of Israel's Defense Ministry, which had overseen bilateral military cooperation. Two planes carrying seven prefab homes flew from Israel to Turkey last week. A ship is being prepared to supply hundreds more structures if required. Turkey initially declined Israel's offer of help. Does this request now help mark some kind of beginning of a turnaround in relations? Shani was circumspect. I think that destruction takes hours. Constructing a building, brick by brick, takes a lot of time. Therefore, every element that we bring to the table will bring about some kind of improvement. We will ultimately reach better days, said Shani. In the Washington, D.C. area, 14 Jewish military chaplains who died serving their country finally have a place of honor in Arlington National Cemetery. Family members of the fallen chaplains were joined by community leaders, politicians, and current and retired military personnel for a ceremony marking the unveiling of the Jewish Chaplains Memorial on Chaplains Hill at Arlington. The new monument contains a plaque inscribed with the names of the 14 Jewish chaplains who died serving during World War II, early years of the Cold War, and in Southeast Asia. It stands beside separate monuments honoring fallen Protestant and Catholic chaplains. They have been on Chaplains Hill since 81 and 89, respectively. Chaplains Hill now represents the diverse fabric that has made our nation stronger, said U.S. Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz. The unveiling marks the culmination of years of effort to create a memorial for Jewish chaplains. The push began with the discovery by amateur historian Ken Kretzer of White Plains, New York, relating to the famous story of the four World War II chaplains, two Protestants, a Catholic, and a Jew, Rabbi Alexander Good, who perished aboard the USS Dorchester in 1943. As the troop transport sunk after being torpedoed by a Nazi submarine, the four chaplains gave away their life jackets to other military personnel, prayed, and consoled others on board. The Catholic and Protestant chaplains were represented on the other monuments at Chaplain's Hill, and Kretzer was surprised and dismayed on a 2007 visit to the site to learn that there was no recognition for Good, or for that matter, any other fallen Jewish chaplains. A whirlwind of phone calls started, letters, meetings, fundraising, advocacy, and so on. Ultimately, a congressional resolution approved the whole thing in May. "And here we are today," Kretzer said, "years later, with this fitting monument to honor much-loved husbands and fathers and sons and brothers, each with his own personal biography that ended too soon." Ernest Heaton, 89 years old, was one of two remaining survivors from the USS Dorchester. He attended the dedication ceremony and recalled the chaplain's bravery. "Rabbi Good's name will live on forever with the other chaplains on these hallowed grounds." And in another story, guess who is now doing international diplomacy?
"My name is George. I'm unemployed and I live with my parents."
Former Seinfeld star Jason Alexander met with a Knesset caucus to discuss the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Alexander has been in Israel as part of a high-profile delegation of international business leaders and philanthropists, and Jason Alexander, under the auspices of One Voice, an international grassroots movement working to promote the two-state solution. The American television star and the rest of the delegation met with the Knesset's Two-State Solution Caucus. The delegation also met with the One Voice movement's Israeli and Palestinian youth activists and attended a town hall meeting in the West Bank Palestinian city of Qalqilya. Alexander asked caucus members why pro-settlement Israelis want to be in the West Bank. Labor Party lawmaker Daniel Ben-Simon responded that it's because the land is biblical. Alexander told the Jerusalem Post that humor has no place in the peace process because someone is always going to be offended.
"I don't understand. Things were going so great. What happened? Something must have happened."
"It's not you. It's me."
"You're giving me the it's not you, it's me routine?" "I invented it's not you, it's me. Nobody tells me it's them, not me. If it's anybody, it's me."
"All right. George, it's you."
"You're damn right it's me."
And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Professor Steve Spiegel, the professor of political science at UCLA, director of the Center for Middle East Development at UCLA, author of the textbook, World Politics in a New Era on International Relations, and the winner of the Karpf Peace Prize back in 1995 for having done the most of any faculty member at UCLA, which, by the way, is my alma mater in the interest of full disclosure, for the cause of world peace. Welcome back. A quick question. Israel has always had a great ability to say, you know, we're the only democracy in the region and we represent American interests best because America supports democracy. Is that helped by the addition of what seemed to be increasingly democratic Arab countries around it?
Well, I think it's premature to talk about increasingly Arab countries. We've had what appears to be a successful election in Tunisia. It might not be the election of the United States
wanted.
Or Israel would necessarily have wanted, because the major Islamist party did the best. But nevertheless, it's moving in that direction. Lebanon has had a very murky experience with democracy, but it's always been able to claim some democracy, though I don't see now how you can have a real democracy when really the major party, one of the major parties, has its own militia, and others do as well. I don't think that the Israeli-American relationship has only been based on Israel as a democracy. Israel will continue as a vibrant democracy, even if there are more democracies in the region, in Egypt and Tunisia and Libya and even Syria, and others emerge as democratic countries. And I think that this only helps the American-Israeli relationship because democracies don't fight wars, political scientists will tell you. It's very rare. So if you had genuine democracies, you'd have a more stable region. Successful democracies, I think, ultimately, it would be better for Israel. And I think it's important to remember that the U.S.-Israeli relationship is much broader than simply Israel being a democracy. It's the Judeo-Christian connection. It's the values. But most important, it's common interests, common attitudes. People forget that Israel, of course, votes with the United States at the United Nations more than any other country. The security cooperation under both recent Republican and Democratic presidents, going back to Clinton, including Bush and Obama. Behind the scenes, the security cooperation is greater than it's ever been. We forget that the drones that have been so successful recently for the American armed forces and for American policy originated with Israel. There are key bandages and other equipment that Israelis have invented that have helped save American soldiers. The relationship is much more complex than just Israel being a democracy. But we should only be so fortunate to have the region populated by democracies. I think we'd all be better off.
You know, it seems to me that the American relationship with Israel has, because of all the different kinds of bilateral cooperation, the intelligence cooperation, and so on, and the strong support for Israel in Congress, the White House's relationship with Israel is, in some ways, the president's relationship with Israel is less crucial than it used to be. Is that wrong?
Well, it's more complicated. I think it is basically right. Obviously, the White House relationship with Israel is extremely important. And there are levels. This administration has been particularly complicated. In a way, the Bush administration, the second Bush administration, was more traditional in a certain sense. So the White House was central, but it was also, in a way, different because the president himself was very committed to Israel and had a very close relationship with the Sharon government and with the Olmert government that he worked with, and was very fond of the Israelis. In this administration, we've got kind of a new pattern where behind the scenes on the security level and the like, the relationship is closer than ever in terms of fighting terrorism, in terms of some of these kind of sub-war levels that the president likes so much, assassinating target killings, assassinating leaders, assassinating bad guys, different types of conflict with drones and the use of trying to undermine the computers in Iran dealing with nuclear weapons. All these are basically the kinds of efforts that Israelis have pioneered in and the president likes, and therefore the Israelis and Americans work quite well together. On the other hand, the president has not been as effective as both Presidents Bush and Clinton before him were in defining the American-Israeli relationship and maintaining close ties. The two leaders, Netanyahu and Obama, don't really get along. Of course, Netanyahu has had a hard time getting along with American presidents. In his first round as prime minister, he didn't get along with Clinton either. But Obama has not been that successful at managing that relationship, even though Netanyahu can be difficult, and the diplomacy has also not been as successful as I think the president intended. Originally, it's been, a real deficit in his foreign policy record, the rest of which has been quite strong, actually. So the relationship is much more difficult to discern. Stronger than ever, behind-the-scenes cooperation on the military security front, but a diplomatic difference which has not made for good public relations in either country. It is interesting, though. Recently, Obama's position has been enhanced, at least in Israel. He's gone from 4% and 12% support among Israelis to 54% now think that he is sympathetic to Israel. A lot of this is because of the Bin Laden assassination, of the fact that the president stepped in with the Egyptian military leadership to save the security officers who were trapped in the...
And the embassy in Cairo, right. So sometimes it's personal action that spells a difference, although it would be interesting to see how long that bump lasts.
I think it's being ameliorated. I think you're going to see in 2012, partially because of the election, you're going to see an improved relationship. I think it's also important to emphasize that Congress, over the years, has become a much stronger proponent of Israel. It always was. But in the early 90s, with the takeover by the House of the Republican Party, the Republicans have switched around. If you look at presidents like Eisenhower, Ford, for example, the first Bush, they were not as enthusiastic as the Democratic counterparts about Israel, and they didn't have as good relations. But now the Republican Party is very solidly sympathetic to Israel, and that does enhance the relationship, and in terms of your original question, does diminish the importance of the White House. And here, you have much more of a bipartisan support for Israel than you ever had in the past. People don't quite realize that.
There was a great perception, I think, of the Jewish community that the State Department was sort of anti-Israel for a very long time, fair or otherwise. What's the real situation?
Well, I think that's completely out of date. I think from the really after the Six-Day War, you had a progressive involvement of American Jews and those who were sympathetic. The State Department, if you look at, you know, the first 60, 70 years of the 20th century and before, was a very Brahmin kind of State Department, not representative of the American polity. Now you have a much greater diversity. Israel is much more part of the scene. I think after the Six-Day War, a lot of Arabists realized that Israel was there to stay and they weren't going to really be able to diminish it. So the State Department now is a much more complex agency than it used to be. You have people who are quite sympathetic to Israel or certainly accept Israel's existence and Israel's role. Of course, many State Department figures are assigned to deal with the Arab world. There are lots more Arab countries than the one Israel, and so people may represent Arab perspectives from time to time, but they also represent frustration with Arab states as well. I don't think you can think about the State Department as sort of the anti-Israel agency the way it was thought about several decades ago.
I want to thank Professor Steve Spiegel for a great visit here on Too Jewish. What's the best place to look for more information, do you think, on the Middle East?
Well, I think in this day and age, the web is best. You've got a lot of particular places. Of course, you do have Al Jazeera, but you also have CNN and the like. But and the Israeli press is extremely good. Our Jerusalem Post. In keeping people abreast of day-to-day activities, and also provides some perspective as well.
Thanks very much, Steve.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Peter Baynard, the journalist and professor whose article, The Failure of the American Jewish Establishment, created a firestorm of comment this year all about Israel. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or on our TooJewishRadio.com website and friend us on Facebook. Our playout this morning comes from Naomi Shemer, and it's for this time of year, just after the Jewish holiday season, HaChadashot. After the holidays, may you be renewed. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
אבל בלבך אתה יודע שמעבר לפינה אהבה חדשה ממתינה אחרי החגים יתחדש הכל יתחדשו וישובו ימי החול האוויר האפר המטר והאר Thank you.
בערבוביה גמורה עץ החלומות ועץ הדעת טוב ורע הסתכל